You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is the 29th of October, 2023. As things continue to heat up, as always, I ask that my friend donate to me either via Patreon or through the Orthodox Medievalist method. That blue box that you can donate, because people like me, you know, are going to become more and more necessary. There's going to be a lot more pressure on us, but in this, you know, the level of mass censorship required for the mythology that people are supposed to believe, you know, it requires ignorance. It requires the Dunning-Kruger idea. It requires people to care less about truth than utility. And of course, more than anything else, care more about money than any other virtue, any other value. I have no choice here but to continue to talk about the Israel-Hamas war, of which there have been many. The massive blackout of information was quite deliberate. No communication in or out of this prison, this open-air prison that Gaza Strip has become, a strip that has no infrastructure. The hospitals have long since been destroyed. About, I think, more than half of both the hospitals and the medical centers have been destroyed. That's nothing new. The Israelis did that in Lebanon, 2006, 2007. They were doing it in the initial establishment of that state with Soviet sponsorship in 1948. This is pretty normal. In fact, the Zionists attacked the Red Cross, much like their Khazar forebears. There are no rules of war here. There's a Talmud and the Talmud alone. And in that regard, of course, I have to recommend Michael Hoffman. Now, last Thursday, my Daily Nationalist, I dealt with the question, the so-called false flag hypothesis, that Netanyahu and Likud not only built up Hamas somehow, kind of short on details there, built up Hamas and permitted the invasion that occurred a few weeks ago. Now, I'm going to touch on that. Of course, I've dealt with that already. I'm going to deal with some of this in far greater detail. Let's put it like this. The point is to terrorize. This is from Erz Shalomsky. The point is to terrorize a civilian population, and he says, assuring maximal destruction of property and cultural resources, the daily life of the Palestinians must be rendered unbearable. They should be locked up in cities and towns, prevented from exercising normal economic life. The constant Israeli attacks, whether it be on whatever bit of the West Bank Palestinians are allowed to live in, Gaza, is... And the same thing goes for the color revolutions and civil wars in Libya, Syria, Iraq, even Sudan. It isn't so much that they no longer are a military threat. They're no longer economically viable. I've said this 100 times before, and I'll say it 100 times again. Most of those countries were on the cusp of first world status. And that's what frightened the Israelis. And the same thing for the Gaza Strip. As Michael Hoffman says, the Israelis slaughter civilians because they know they can get away with it. That's the sheer power. Calling them animals, attacking civilian centers, without the tiniest reference to why in heaven's name these men would want to risk their lives, the lives of their families, in this desperate gamble to internationalize the grinding poverty of the Gaza Strip. The Gaza Strip has no economy. It doesn't function at any level. And the huge blockade has been going on since at least 2007. There's nothing new about that. They've just tightened it up a little bit. Well, most of you already know, on the 7th of October, Hamas retaliated against Israel's policy in Gaza. They're bombing there on a regular basis. They overran about 50 IDF positions and captured about 30 Israeli soldiers and settlers. The IDF put into action Operation Iron Swords, with Hamas, you know, taking a calculated risk that Iran and Hezbollah, not to mention Turkey and Saudi Arabia, can be mobilized once the crackdown begins. Hezbollah, highly experienced, well-financed, and well-armed guerrilla fighters who've won victories in Lebanon in the past against the South Lebanon Army, are far too much for the Americans or even the Israelis to handle. It's been said that the greatest soldiers in the area now are Hezbollah, not Israel. Now, Netanyahu has made the claim that Hamas is useful to him. Now, the evidence that money was directly given from Tel Aviv to Hamas is non-existent. So it has to be indirectly. We're going to get to that in more detail here in a minute. And another motive here is that the Oslo Accords, which was when Arafat was still alive and Isaac Rabin, Prime Minister of Israel, created an interim Palestinian self-government, hence the Palestine Authority, for the occupied territories, and that's a temporary arrangement until the UN will craft a permanent one. Besides that, Netanyahu wanted to put Hamas and al-Fatah at odds, which failed. In fact, most of these gambits failed. In fact, the alliance between the Palestinian National Authority and Hamas is a pretty old one now. And, you know, the claim that Hamas was nursed and remotely run by the Mossad is very tough to justify. It's very tough to prove. But it's important to note how deeply divided Israeli society is. The government has lost a lot of credit with the population under Netanyahu. His alliance with the most extreme settler movements, and his judicial reform bills, which his party and his movement created, ultimately it's a matter of law now, removing many powers from the Israeli Supreme Court, even centralizing the power to choose who sits on it. The legislature can override anything the Supreme Court says, and even limits the subject matter that can come before the court. And it just so happens that the court has occasionally sided with Palestinians over land issues, and they can no longer get in the way of Israeli expansionism. And the law has split the country. And believe it or not, even the IDF had condemned it in public. Hundreds of military personnel there were willing to refuse orders. They were joined by the Israeli Medical Association, labor unions. The former president of Israel, Reuven Rivlin, just begged Netanyahu to stop this law and even said civil war is possible. So you have reason for a huge schism in Israeli society. As I've said before, in Israel, the security services are stretched to the limit. There is a schism between the reservists, who have been mobilized, about 400,000 of them, and the government, as well as the brass of the military. Reservists are these draftees. The reservists were also the ones who didn't want to follow orders, and they still have to be trained. Israel has a core of maybe 100,000 men under arms, but that's nowhere near enough. Settler violence in the West Bank, and even parts of Jerusalem, has increased the security concerns that the Zionist entity has to deal with. But let me pause here, and I want to talk about the settlers. Sometimes I forget that not everyone understands some of these things. And what the heck is a settler? And what's an Israeli settlement? Well, from 1967 to more recently, in 2018 or something, there were 200 separate Israeli communities established just in the West Bank. These are small communities of Israelis who steal land, they're armed, and create a small community with government subsidies. Then the army comes in, surrounds them, and the Palestinians are kept out. It's an outrageous policy. It's to expand Israel's borders. So you have those recognized by the Ministry of the Interior, about 130 of them, and then 110 of them have no authorization, but they ended up having, they're called illegal outposts. West Bank has at least 11 full neighborhoods annexed to the municipal jurisdiction of Jerusalem, 67. And there's a handful of Palestinian enclaves. Now, there were 16 in the Gaza Strip, but they were withdrawn in 2005, not because they gave a damn about Palestinians, but because they were going to destroy Gaza. People don't realize that in the West Bank, only a small minority of the territory, only within that small territory are Palestinians permitted. Overall, the settlements are about almost 700,000 Jews, and 200,000 of those live in the West Bank. Well, really more than that, actually, I should say, you know, maybe 413,000 live throughout the rest of the West Bank. And, you know, these settlements are built on Palestinian land. Don't forget, there's 40 IDF bases in the West Bank, and all of that is state land. Once a settlement is established, especially if there's a few of them, they redo the roads, they set up roadblocks, and completely control Palestinian movement. Palestinian landowners have been denied access to their farmland. The huge separation barrier required the theft of a lot of Palestinian land. And that separation barrier was meant to protect as many settlements as possible. Now, initially, settlements were based on land that was stolen by the IDF for military purposes. So you had about, the unit of measure is a dunam. One dunam is about 1,000 square meters. Initially, it was about 31,000 of that. A dunam, which was earmarked for building settlements. Now, it was, the Palestinians went to the Supreme Court, the High Court of Justice, arguing that all of these seizures violate international law, because they're not military, they're not of military use. They're, in fact, for civilian profit. And the court rejected the argument. Even though the top security people said these lands have been stolen and don't serve a military purpose. And because of subsidies that come not just from Tel Aviv, but also from wealthy Jews all over the world, especially the U.S., they have created almost a mini civilization, even employing on occasion Palestinian workers. And of course, the labor rights legislation in Israel does not apply to them. That's also something the court stated. Now, the Supreme Court did say, though, when private land is taken for the sake of establishing a settlement, rather than for military, the military apparatus, they will render it unlawful. It requires, the state has to agree with the top security officials about the advantage of every planned settlement. And the settlers, of course, don't tell anybody what they're doing. But in the West Bank, almost a million dunams of land were considered state land, you know, near the Jordan Valley. And it's very easy to declare state land here. Even when the land in question was a private or even collective Palestinian property under British and then later under Jordan, they had all kinds of legal methods to kick them off the land. One of the ways was requiring Palestinians to be there on the land to cultivate it. That's a prerequisite for acquiring ownership. The rejection of all local laws that give communities, Palestinian communities, a collective right to use these grazing areas and other public lands. So as this is going on from, say, 79 to the beginning of the 2000s, the majority of the West Bank was stolen from Palestinians and handed over either to the military, settlers, or both. So we're really talking about half, at least, I should say, half the West Bank the Palestinians not only do not own, but can't go into. The whole thing is based on fraud. The UN has condemned settlements. And, of course, the IDF, or you know, Israeli military law is imposed, but that only applies to Jews. Palestinians, of course, are killed all the time by settlers. Settlers are the most fanatical of the Zionists. And it's rare that people even talk about them. So that's the nature of the settlement. It's because there are Jews living there, the army then goes in and protects them, and hence that becomes a part of Israel, not officially, but very much unofficially. Now, it's against international law, not that that's a big deal, because you can't, an occupying power can't relocate its citizens, nor can it make permanent changes to a territory that's not its own. The only exception is if they're needed for immediate military needs, or at an absolute minimum, undertaken for the benefit of the locals. But private property rights don't exist for Arabs. There's no question of law. There's no adequate standard of living. There's no freedom of movement. And keep in mind that all of this is fully consistent with Israel being a democracy. That's very important to note. Just like the one-party totalitarian state in Kiev is considered free and democratic, according to the U.S. State Department and most academics. Now, I will mention some of the problems. These are writers that I respect, Paul Craig Roberts, Philip Girardi, and, of course, the famous Michael Chasudovsky, claiming that what happened on the 7th is not an intelligence failure. This was something that was deliberate. Now, on October 9th, 2023, all the IDF did was increase the intensity of the blockade on Gaza. Gaza has an unemployment rate of something like 60 or 70%. There's no freedom of movement. There's no law there. Israel attacks its infrastructure at will. And you have, you know, you even have military men like the former IDF officer, Aflat Fenixon, who said that very same day, he said, there's no way Israel didn't know what was going on. They did receive warnings, or so I'm told, from Egypt, and they were ignored. Now, that doesn't prove anything. I just think it's a terrible idea for someone like Netanyahu to foster a movement like this. But keep in mind, Hamas is a footnote compared to Hezbollah. What we know from Netanyahu's point of view is that he says this is going to change everything. And the agenda is clear: to get rid of the population of Gaza and absorb that into Israel. Problem is, there's nowhere for these 2.5 million people to go. The Gaza Strip is the most densely populated place on earth. Now, I said last week, I said my biggest problem with the false flag idea is that it removes all competence and agency from Hamas. Why are they incapable of pulling something like this off without Israeli support? The arms, whether it be in Hezbollah in Lebanon or Hamas in the Gaza Strip, their arms have been hidden for a long time. Hezbollah is far better armed than Hamas. And of course, the real wild card is Turkey. Turkey has never really gotten heavily involved in Israeli politics until now. Representatives from Hamas were in Moscow a few days ago. In fact, they may still be there. Putin has condemned the Israeli policy, and they're corresponding with the Iranian. Again, you know, this is what Putin is doing. I don't know what more this man can do to show that he's on the level here. But of course, he was the first to recognize the Hamas victory in 2006 in the first place, and assisted and helped in aiding Gaza Strip. Sure, there's been aid from the UN and other organizations going into Gaza Strip after 2005, where the Israelis pulled out. But as I said before, the significance of Hamas for Tel Aviv is that they can administer the Strip so that Israel doesn't have to. Don't forget, too, this summer you saw a full Israeli invasion of the West Bank. It's not an accident that Hamas would take the action that it did just a few months later, and especially when it's very clear that Russia has long since won in Ukraine and the U.S. simply doesn't have the weapons anymore. But if anyone was to think that the Hamas invasion was meant to unify Israel, they were dead wrong. And it shouldn't even have been expected. It's more divided now than it was before. About 85% of Israelis blame Netanyahu for this. It's a political disaster for him. His career is over. And just as importantly, Gaza has nothing to lose. There is no way Israel can absorb an angry armed population of 2.5 million Arabs. Again, Israel's overstretched as it is. Now, on the other hand, as many of you know, I was the first to make the argument that ISIS was a, you know, complete Western creation, financed, supported, and armed. The United States did not engage in any anti-ISIS action, or anti-Al-Qaeda for that matter. This is something that the Lebanese said, the Syrians said, the Iranians said, and without question the Russians said, because the damage that was done to that organization, completely condemned by the Americans, by the way, was from Russia. You know, a few years ago, I was summarizing all the times where Russia attacked an ISIS position and the U.S. condemned it. But ISIS is not Hamas. ISIS has refused to attack any Zionist entity. It only attacks opponents of Israel and the U.S., in stark contrast to Hamas. Somehow, ISIS overnight got a fleet of oil tankers, a banking system, a currency, regular army structure. They never run out of ammunition. And yet, Hamas is very different from that. They're not wealthy. They're a guerrilla force. ISIS is a regular army. And of course, ISIS has offered nothing to Hamas these days. And there's a reason for that. It's because ISIS is an enemy to any organized Palestinian or Islamic armed force anywhere. Aid has come into the impoverished Gaza Strip, a lot of it from the United Nations, Since 2014, the UN has spent about $5 billion there. And the Sheikhdom of Qatar has been, and really all of the Gulf states are regularly sending money via Islamic channels to the Gaza Strip in particular. I also find it impossible that Hamas would accept money if they knew it was somehow from the Israelis. It's true that Israel had to approve this money coming from the Gulf states to Gaza. But part of the reason for that, part of the justification for that approval, was that the Gulf states then had to keep a leash on Hamas. In fact, Israel just wouldn't permit this transfer of any funds or any goods unless there's a guarantee of peace from the Gulf states. Again, the idea that Hamas was financed by Israel is laughable. I mean, why not just lift the blockade? What's the point of, you know, assassinating? God, since 1996, the Mossad has assassinated like 7 or 8 top leadership of Hamas. Why don't they just not do that? Any money that the claim is that any money that has gone to the Gaza Strip has long since been lost. So Israel deliberately destroys the economy, but has no problem sending money to Hamas. And how could they do this? Do they have a joint bank account somewhere? But given the blockade, and again, it gets more intense as time goes on. It was intensified in 2014, and even worse now. Hamas and Hezbollah are primarily social service organizations. Because the poverty is so grinding in the Gaza Strip, Hamas's main mission is to feed the population. It's one of the reasons that Israel, while always condemning Hamas, you know, permitted them to, I mean, they were very popular. They won the election in 2006, and they administer the Gaza Strip so Israel doesn't have to. Israel lost faith in the Palestinian Authority to control the militants. At most, it's a benign neglect of Gaza. You know, Hamas was permitted to keep Islamic Jihad in check, pay the bureaucrats in government, and of course keep a total humanitarian catastrophe from happening. Of course, that didn't work either. 2008, 2009, Israel yet again destroyed the Gaza economy and infrastructure. People have made a big deal about the hospital, and yet 15 hospitals were blown up in 2008, 2009. 43 healthcare facilities in total were destroyed. What little farming is there, about 10,000 family farms, were also destroyed. This is extremely important. But we want to talk about what's motivating Hamas. And certainly not because Israel permitted it. But prior to October 7th, Gaza was on the verge of total dissolution. Not just physically, but mentally. Every few years, when Israel bombs and destroys parts of Gaza, you have little kids who are traumatized for life. Then they grow up, and then their kids see the same thing. The Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have nothing. No one in the world lives as they do. Only Israel can get away with this level of deprivation. They're caged in Gaza. They have no hope for the future. They cut off electricity and fuel almost completely years ago. They've been under siege for 20 years, fully accepted by the U.S., and even necessities are blocked. The Gaza Strip is uninhabitable. The U.N. declared it to be too contaminated to sustain life. There's no fresh water thanks to Israel. Israel fires on fishermen. But even before all this, Israel took a third of Gaza's agricultural land. They've stolen the water, they've stolen the land, and of course, stealing the natural gas, off the coast of Gaza. Natural gas that the Supreme Court at one point said belonged to the Palestinians. Again, which goes far to explain the judicial reform from Netanyahu. Gazans are dying every day via Israeli policy. Somehow, because of Jewish power, there's a complete blank spot on the American mind. Nobody acts this way in the world. You know, Mao, Stalin, Israel. Germany, as you know, has banned any action in favor of the Palestinians, any mourning, anything like that. And and this is actually even before the invasion, the law that was promoted by the National Security Minister, Itamar Gavir, Ben-Gavir, and it granted immunity for soldiers and policemen who shoot Palestinians. It's essentially a license to kill. Hamas had no choice but to bring their situation to world attention by inviting what's going on. Certainly not in the interest of Zionism. The term Nakba, the mass expulsion, which existed at Israel's founding, and now they're calling for a second one. This is not a secret. Totaled the population of the Gaza Strip. The IDF is telling at least those in northern Gaza to flee via Egypt, but that border is closed. But the humanitarian disaster is obviously deliberate IDF policy. They have nowhere to go, and even if they were to go, they have nothing to come home to. The IDF came right out and said, we're going to turn Gaza into a city of tents. But something like that, that's the normal radical Zionist position under all conditions. Entire districts, entire residential areas in Gaza are being pummeled through artillery, missiles or bombs, war crimes that are taking place by deliberate design. The point is to murder civilians. Now, another issue for Israel is the ability to possibly decapitate Iran and Hezbollah. Now, that is anything but inevitable. After all, Hamas shattered the myth of Israel's invincibility. Actually, I think that myth was destroyed in 2000 when Hezbollah defeated both the IDF and the South Lebanon Army. The occupied territories come from the 1967 Six-Day War, where three Arab armies were defeated. And this is where the occupied territories come from. There's that victory. The depopulation agenda is clear, and it has American backing, and it is considered synonymous with democracy. You know how many times I've talked about what the word democracy means in the regime's mind? Well, it is consistent with all of them. Hezbollah remains the best equipped and best trained armed group that Israel faces. Now, they've long called for a general mobilization, something that Israel, I think, had to have known. The foreign minister in Iran has spoken of the crimes against the Palestinians, where there will be a response from the resistance axis. Palestinian unity with Arab sponsorship, not to mention Turkish sponsorship, may force Israel's hand here. It is far from clear that Zionism has an upper hand. That's far from clear. And besides all that, Netanyahu must not have been aware that because of the Arab outrage over the IDF policy in Gaza, all of these lucrative trade deals that they were just signing with the Gulf states are now gone. Any government controlled by a political class that wants to play nice with Israel now is under so much pressure from the population, that it's going to be a miracle if any of those governments remain. And bringing to power militant and popular leaders directly supporting Hamas. The two carriers heading to the Lebanese coast aren't particularly impressive. I mean, the U.S. and the EU were already dealing with the failure in Ukraine, not to mention the equally humiliating American defeat in Afghanistan. I tend to doubt that the American oligarchy has a stomach for a lot more. In fact, it was Blinken and that moron Lloyd Austin that went over there to try to calm things down. But as of now, there are two Islamic countries that can successfully challenge Israel: Iran and Turkey. Again, Syria, Iraq, Sudan, Libya, they've been reduced to third world status, which was Tel Aviv's goal. Israel has an interest in using the U.S. to keep her rivals poor and ignorant. For the first time, the Turkish government is vehemently condemning Israel. Turkey has not been a huge player here, but the Americans are very much dependent on NATO bases in Turkey to be able to function. NATO may be history. Turkey has about 750,000 first world soldiers. It's a first world country. And they know all of NATO's secrets. Iran, if you remember some years ago, I did a full lecture on Iran as a first world country. And I used the book, which I recommend, Guardians of the Revolution, Iran and in the World in the Age of the Ayatollahs, from Oxford University Press. The truth is, contrary to the mythology, remember, almost everything the average American believes about the world is a myth. Iran is a multi-party democracy and has a first world economy. She's 14th in the world, as of a few years ago, the number of daily newspapers per capita. Iran has the 18th largest economy on the planet and one of the fastest growing economies, at least up until very recently. Iranian life expectancy is 74. Iran has the world's fourth highest government budget surplus, and she's the eighth least indebted country on the planet. Her gold reserves are the eighth largest in the world. And an interesting statistic here: Iran is 14th in the world in terms of wages relative to business expenses. In other words, of all the daily functional expenses that a company has in Iran, a larger proportion of that goes to their workers than most other places on the planet. That's why energy is, among other reasons, energy is so inexpensive there. They're 24th in the world in terms of the number of small, medium-sized businesses. She has a 9th highest number of book titles published each year, and 7th in the world in scientific texts published, 3rd in university enrollments. She has the lowest suicide and the lowest cancer rate, I think, on the planet. Actually, in terms of cancer, Iran is 148 out of 194. It's extraordinary. And it's a multi-party democracy, as I've said. You have the Modern Thinkers Party, Party of Engineers for Scientific Development, the Combatant Clergy Association, the Islamic Coalition Party, Moderation and Development Party. Now, they have to be Islamic, but that's not particularly interesting in Iran. And, of course, their military is enormous. Iran's relationships with its neighbors, especially now that the Gulf states have made their peace with Iran, thanks to Saudi Arabia, which is an earth-shattering concept. I did it on the Daily Nationalist some months ago. Iran, just like Russia, the economy just shifted its focus. You know, sanctions don't mean a lot when you have allies like Russia and China, and the wealthy Gulf states now don't see you as a threat. That was a huge factor in Middle Eastern politics, is that Iran was seen as a threat to the various monarchies. And the huge economic growth in the 90s, 2000s, oil accounts for less than 50% of this growth. In fact, oil accounts for 18% of the Iranian GDP. Again, everything that the average American believes about the world is false, is a story. Iran is an extraordinary place, as is Turkey. And this is why I'm saying it is far from a done deal that Israel comes out of this the victor. From the point of view of the regime, of the oligarchy, we know what's happening in Ukraine. Avdiivka, which is actually a fortress city, is the NATO headquarters. Russia is now surrounding it. Russian soldiers are moving freely wherever they go. They don't have to worry about getting picked off or anything like that. And now the pincer movement to trap what's left of the Ukrainian infantry at Kupiansk is almost complete. That's a huge humiliation coming on the heels of the humiliation in Afghanistan and the defeat that the regime suffered in Syria for now. The bases that the U.S. has in Syria is under al-Qaeda territory and is there for many other reasons to possibly invite a war. They have no right to be there. They're an occupying power. These governments have every right to take action against them. The U.S. has already run out of artillery shells, anti-air missiles. So if there's any notion of the Americans giving any ammunition, especially heavy ammunition, to Israel, the U.S. won't have any left. If there's a conflict somewhere else, they won't be able to deal with it. The U.S. is radically unprepared militarily. The U.S. is incapable of managing conflict, especially if you have something like Taiwan or Iran or Turkey. The defeat in Ukraine was humiliating. And the great tragedy is how that Slavic Orthodox country has now been depopulated. When it comes to the Jewish elite, depopulation is a pretty normal mentality. The U.S. empire is badly overstretched, as the Israeli one. Turkey is going to double its military spending over the next year. The American regime wants to see the same thing happen in the U.S. despite there not being any money. You're talking about the defense budget is more than $1 trillion a year. I know that's not necessarily what it says in the budget, but that kind of spending is spread out all over the place, not just in the defense budget. So it's at least $1 trillion. If that's to be doubled, they have to add another $1 trillion to this. The debt, at least just the public sector debt, the interest payments are $1 trillion every year. So where is this money coming from? There's certainly nowhere to cut. And it's not even to say that the U.S. will ever give up its ambitions to control the world this way. But Washington has come up against the wall of military impossibility. After decades of deliberate deindustrialization in the U.S., for the short-term profits of the oligarchy, the U.S. has no capacity for increased production, even if it had the money. The assumption that somehow Israel's going to win this automatically is hasty. After 2 decades, the U.S. couldn't defeat the Taliban. And Hamas will end the same way. Talk about motivation. Hezbollah has a huge stock of rockets. Israel is almost out of air defense weapons for the same reason that Ukraine is. Israel is vulnerable. The last time Israel invaded Lebanon, Hezbollah stopped the Israeli tanks and destroyed their proxy South Lebanon army. I'm willing to bet that a lot of what's on these two carriers isn't battle ready. I don't believe that at all. Partially. But we're talking about, just abstract from Turkey and Iran for a minute. Just Hamas and Hezbollah are experienced, extremely competent guerrilla forces. The false flag idea implies that, Mossad has so heavily penetrated Hamas, they get to do Israel's bidding. As if all of these decades of guerrilla war hasn't given them the means and methods whereby they can detect this stuff. Hezbollah, and it's not just their own claim, has penetrated the IDF. This is what these guys have been doing in the meantime. Do not think of these groups as ragtag thugs. They're nothing of the kind. And the false flag thesis really derives from that attitude. whatever, you know, the biggest argument against the false flag thesis is that no matter what set of motivations you can ascribe to Netanyahu or the Likud party, none of it has come true. None of it has come to pass. The exact opposite. There's no way to end the Palestinian problem. There are simply too many of them. Egypt is not going to allow the influx of a million Gazans or 2 million Gazans anytime soon. Their economy, since the color revolution occurred a few years ago, their economy is teetering on the brink. But this is not even to say that Hamas doesn't have a certain limited use for Israel. I don't think anyone denies that. Israel hasn't been financing them, but that money has come from Qatar. Israel may approve it. And certainly there's no money sent directly to Hamas, although they're the ones who ultimately spend it. Hamas would destroy itself if they accepted Israeli money. Very unlikely event. There's this quote that Netanyahu made in 2019 to the Knesset that if you want to destroy the Palestinian Authority, you have to support Hamas. Now, I'm not entirely sure if Netanyahu is going to do something that outrageous, he's going to announce it to the Knesset. The Arabs send aid to Gaza all the time. Not necessarily to Gaza, to Hamas as such, but to immediate poverty and famine relief, the famine that Israel created. I mean, Israel sent weapons to Iran in the 80s because it wanted its two rivals to destroy each other on a very specific point in history. There are very few Israeli weapons in the Hamas or Hezbollah armory, unlike the ISIS one. The blockade has been absolutely inhuman. Hamas has been permitted to keep a lid on things, but their patience has run out. I noted before that Hamas is not this rejectionist extreme movement. They have long since, prior to this, been in negotiations with Israel over the 1967 borders, the two-state solution. If the point was to separate Hamas and the Palestine Authority, well, that failed miserably because Hamas and Fatah have signed truces in 2005, 2006, and then again in 2007. In the beginning, they hated each other, it's true, but that's history. They're not total opposites. They're not constant enemies. I mean, Hamas went so far, right after they were elected, 2006, Hamas said they would refrain from attacking Israel if the IDF ended its offensives against Palestine, especially in the West Bank. And I think that included lifting the sanctions on Gaza. Abbas, who's, Arafat's successor, in 2012 went so far as to say that there's no political differences between Hamas and the PA, or Fatah. They even reached agreement on a joint political platform. Of course, it's in their interest to present a unified front. And the reason I got into the Iranian situation so intensely is they're a first world military, as is Turkey. The U.S. has never fought them. The Israelis have never directly fought them. It would be a mistake to take them on. Because if there's anything that's going to unify Muslims, I don't care what planet they live on, it's going to be the slaughter in Gaza. Now, I started off by saying that the security situation in Israel is on the brink. We saw riots in Tel Aviv and other major cities, not from Arabs, but from Jews. Netanyahu is allowing towns and cities to vet anyone who wants to move there, which is just a way to get rid of any Arabs. No wonder the left finally broke its silence on Israel, up until, of course, the 7th of October. The settler movement is a massive drain on Israel. There is no party, there is no movement, and let me stick to party. The two major parties, neither one is opposed to the settlements. One of the reasons that the the Israelis were not manning the wall as much as they usually do was that the settler violence created a crisis in the West Bank, and they were withdrawn from the wall and had to do security detail for the Sukkot celebration, the famous little village of Huwara. The local military authorities, with the approval of Netanyahu, ordered two of the three battalions that guard that area to shift their focus to the West Bank. The reservists, as they exist now, the conscripts are not trained. And they're certainly not trained against an experienced, extremely motivated, and extremely well-armed Hamas, or Hezbollah, for that matter. The IDF is dealing with a manpower shortage. They are at 110% mobilization. They can't fit anymore. There's only so many of them. The settlements have been a huge drain on Israel. Yes, the policy is one that's accepted by Tel Aviv 100%. But the security concerns that settlers cause, I mean, you have, you know, they kick 100,000 Palestinians off their land, just steal it, surround it with a huge fence, the army coming in to protect them. You're going to get a lot of anger. You're going to have a lot of enemies. Throwing Palestinians off the land and forbidding them to spend money or to farm the land is day-to-day. It's really not even, you know, controversial anymore. It's an open secret, I guess. I mean, they talk about it all the time in the Knesset. Now, you do have some so-called left-wing Israelis who are opposed to the settler policy. But there's a Zionist reason to be concerned with that. The Israeli security services are stretched to the breaking point. And that's not including the concept that you have this schism within the army itself over the judicial reform. Israel had never been convulsed by riots and protest before. Even the U.S., I mean, Netanyahu blamed idiot Biden for what happened on the 7th. Because even the American rhetoric was very worried about Netanyahu's policies. Netanyahu, you know, from a Jewish point of view, Netanyahu has to answer for at least 5,000 Israeli deaths. They're not releasing military casualties, but it's at least 1,000 right now. One of the reasons that Hamas had to take hostages is that they're not a country. They don't have the bureaucracy that Israel does. They don't have anything that Israel does. Israel, in theory, has unlimited money. As I said then, and I'll say now, it very briefly became mainstream to criticize Israel over the Netanyahu issue because they couched it as an anti-right-wing criticism. There was no rally around the flag, nothing like that. To view that Hamas and Hezbollah are just thugs is ridiculous. They're a highly sophisticated guerrilla force with their own intelligence, with a high-tech sector, believe it or not, Hezbollah especially coming from Iran. And it isn't just the Iranians that the Americans have to worry about, it's the Turks. The point is that the pressure on civilian governments in the Arab world is so intense that they can't even give the impression that they're moderate on their condemnation of Israel. In fact, you have elites in Turkish society all over the place saying that Erdogan's rhetoric is too late and is not harsh enough. Russia, of course, has lines of communication. Russia, as I said, they recognize the Hamas victory. They're the first ones to do so and have been sending limited aid into Gaza. Iran and Russia are allies. The Iranian economy, for example, has simply shifted a lot of its activity to the Chinese. And, of course, the Gulf state issue, as I mentioned, which is a huge revolution as how work is done there. Nothing is the same. The old ways of doing things after this are null and void. Hamas's action will embolden the enemies of Israel. And one of the key problems, as I've said 1,000 times, is believing that Iran or Turkey or Hezbollah are these third world guerrillas, third world countries. They're anything but. The Iranian economy is far more stable than the American. Israel does what it does because they're Jews, because they know that they control much of the world's media. No one is getting any reliable information out of the Gaza Strip right now. That means the American media can simply make stuff up. Some of you may remember the beheaded babies thing. Can you imagine someone seriously put that forward as an actual crime? The Gaza hospital, again, the one that everyone was talking about, they've destroyed more hospitals than that. The Hamas rocketry, actually, they're now saying it was the Islamic Jihad rocketry, really isn't strong enough or concentrated enough to do what the Israeli missile did to that hospital, the Baptist hospital. Don't underestimate their motivation. Israel is going into this weaker than it ever has been, because it's simply more divided with more issues to worry about. When the U.S. criticized Israel over the Netanyahu reforms, that had never happened before either. Gazans have no hope for the future. Hamas's interest is to fight for the Arabs in the Gaza Strip and elsewhere, to join up with Hezbollah, and to open up channels with Russia, Turkey, and Iran. Israel is in serious trouble because any government that has moderates in it may well be overthrown. I mean, these protests in favor of Gaza are huge. To think that Israel's going to pull this out in the end is not inevitable. And I guarantee you, behind closed doors, IDF generals and colonels are extremely worried. Iran isn't the third world country it was 30 years ago. Everything has changed. Israel has already suffered defeat at the hands of Hezbollah. Hezbollah has the capacity to destroy most Israeli cities. And if anyone's worried about them killing civilians, well, the Israelis created that. They're the first ones to start targeting civilians. And I tell you, there's one group you're not going to hear from, and that's ISIS. Because that is a complete Western creation. I have several papers on my Patreon page, which I recommend you subscribe to. It's $5. Again, I said last week, the $5 is from Patreon itself, not from me. And I strongly recommend you access my Patreon, because what I'm doing here is just a thumbnail sketch of what I have in writing there. I also recommend Michael Hoffman, E. Michael Jones on this. E. Michael Jones deals with the cultural issues. Michael Hoffman deals with the legal issues. This may be the beginning of the end for the oligarchy. The Ukraine situation, the Iran situation, Syria situation, the invasion of Israel, and the absolutely suicidal response from the IDF. Even the New York Times said that Gaza is a trap for Israel rather than a benefit to them. Military hardware is in very short supply thanks to the idiotic policy in Ukraine. There's no money. There's no will. And the Americans are so befuddled and confused, they'd go along just because they're scared to do anything else. In the nationalist movement, there's been quite a bit of disagreement on the nature of this war. But this is something I've been studying since college. And Israel is the creation of lies, of mistaken identity, and the problems that it has are from its own actions. Thank you, everyone, as always, for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.